This program is a production of the LA Sound Posse and is dedicated to the public domain. Please feel free to copy and share it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized civic media. The following is a presentation by veteran New York Times correspondent Christopher Hedges, entitled War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. This talk was delivered at University of California, Santa Barbara, October 11th, 2004.
To do the formal introduction, it's my pleasure to introduce Chris Newfield, who teaches here in the UCSB English department. He's been a big supporter of the Arts and Lectures program and all the great things that happen on campus. Chris Newfield.
One of my great distinctions is that I'm one of Roman's greatest fans. It's a real pleasure to introduce Chris Hedges tonight. As the reality of war becomes less precise and less visible in the American media, we need more than ever the thinking and writing of correspondents who have seen that reality for themselves. During the post-Vietnam era, the path of war has run through most of the regions of the world, and Chris Hedges has spent most of his adult life on that path bearing witness to war's results. He spent 5 years in El Salvador during the 1980s, moved on to Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Colombia, saw the first intifada on the West Bank and Gaza, the civil wars in the Sudan and Yemen, the uprisings in Algeria and the Punjab, the Gulf War of the early 1990s, the Kurdish rebellion in the region shared by Turkey and Iraq, and the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. After having spent those years filing countless reports from the front lines of these conflicts, Mr. Hedges has distilled not just the lessons, but the psychological effects of war in his remarkable book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. The numerous and laudatory reviews have acknowledged that in the swarm of war books that have appeared since 9/11, this work stands out for the profundity of both its questions and its answers. If Chris Hedges has evolved from war reporter to war philosopher, he has remained nonetheless eminently practical. He has recently published a second book called What Every Person Should Know About War. There he asks and answers such questions as, what are my chances of being wounded or killed if we go to war? What do artillery shells do to you? Will I be afraid? What will happen to my body after I die? The book is written not for opinion leaders, but for ordinary recruits who are attracted to war's images of glory and heroism, but who know little of its reality. Many of you here tonight, as I saw from the show of hands, heard Seymour Hersh speak yesterday. Well, where Hersh reports on the making of war policy, Chris Hedges has become a reporter of war culture. Mr. Hersh has asked the question, how did 8 or 9 people seize control of American foreign policy and start a war? Mr. Hedges asks a complementary and perhaps more disturbing question. Why did 80 or 90 million people support the war? Why do national majorities regularly support war? Why is it that in similar circumstances, the public will most likely support war again? For commentary on these and other pressing questions, please join me in giving a big Santa Barbara welcome for Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you very much for having me tonight. I have, as Chris said, spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering wars in Central America and the Middle East and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by the organized industrial violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American dirt roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of mothers, keening over the lifeless and mutilated bodies of their children. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathe death into my lungs. I carry within me the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades, now gone. War has found me, found us out again. We have blundered into nations we know little about, caught between bitter rivalries between competing ethnic and religious groups, and we have embarked on an occupation in Iraq that is as damaging to our souls as it is to our prestige and power and security. We have become tyrants to others weaker than ourselves, and we believe falsely that because we have the capacity to wage war, we have the right to wage war. Once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. In Antigone, the king imposes his will without listening to those he rules and dooms himself. Thucydides wrote of Athens' expanding empire and how this empire led it to become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. The tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. The lust for war and the desire for profits led the Athenians to lose sight of democratic ideals, ideals that are their legacy to us and should be our legacy to others. We are fed images and slogans that perpetuate fantasies about our own invulnerability, our own might, our own goodness. And these illusions blind us. We cannot see ourselves as others see us. We had fed the heart on fantasies, William Butler Yeats wrote, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. It is 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and we have become Israel. Our empire has expanded. We have become pariahs, and we are propelled forward not by logic or compassion or understanding, but by fear. We have created and live in a world where violence has become the primary form of communication, and we have built an alliance against terror with Ariel Sharon and Vladimir Putin, two men who do not shrink from gratuitous and senseless killing in the Israeli-occupied territories and Chechnya. In those who are not with us, and few are with us now, we ridicule and belittle and condemn. We have become the company we keep. Much of the world, certainly the Muslim world, one-fifth of the world's population, most of whom, I remind you, are not Arab, see us through the prism of Iraq, Palestine, and Chechnya. And this prism is one that is igniting the dispossessed and deteriorating by the hour our security and safety. The attacks on the World Trade Center illustrate that those who oppose us, rather than coming from another moral universe, have been schooled well in modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims plummeting to their deaths, the collapse of the towers in Manhattan, were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide bombers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They understand that the use of indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement, and we leave the same calling cards. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Serbia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara who, in the summer of 1965, defined the bombing raids that would kill hundreds of thousands of civilians north of Saigon as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. The seduction of war is insidious. It appears to be a way to eradicate our enemies, to banish from the world of the living those who would do us harm. At a time when we are afraid, it gives us a false sense of power and security. Of course, we never saw the war in Iraq. The press always masks the essence of war, death, from public view. The coverage was presented as a game, as entertainment, and commentators on the cable news channels reveled in the power and might of our weaponry and, by extension, our own power. We watched neatly packaged video clips fed to the press by the war makers, and we were spared the pools of blood, the agony of the dying on the other end. It was clean and neat and tidy and wildly out of context. There was the technological capacity to show us war. We could have watched live footage of a young Iraqi soldier with his legs blown off by an anti-tank mine dying in the sand, something I saw in the Persian Gulf War. But such coverage would hardly boost ratings, hardly make us want to wage war. We were fed the myth the press almost always feeds us in wartime, and kept from seeing. There has been no more candor in Iraq or Afghanistan than there was in Vietnam, but in the age of live satellite feeds, the military has perfected the appearance of candor. For the myth of war, the myth of glory and honor, sells newspapers and boosts ratings. Real war reporting does not. Look at CNN, Fox, MSNBC. Nearly every embedded correspondent saw his or her mission as sustaining civilian and army morale. The identification of reporters with the units they cover is insipid and dangerous, but also usual, for in war, the press is always part of the problem. In wartime, as Senator Hiram Johnson reminded us in 1917, truth is the first casualty. We have lost touch with the essence of war. After our defeat in Vietnam, we became a better nation. We were humbled, even humiliated. We asked questions about ourselves we had not asked before. We were forced to see ourselves as others saw us. The sight was not an attractive one. We were forced to confront our own capacity for atrocity, for evil, and in this we understood not only war, but ourselves. But this humility is gone. The good name of war has been resurrected. It began under President Reagan and Grenada and Panama and culminated in the Persian Gulf War. We have been led to believe, in the same way the doomed empires of the late 19th century believed, that our technology makes us invulnerable, a lie sadly unmasked as I speak tonight in the streets of Baghdad. War is the pornography of violence. It has a dark beauty filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning. It creates a feeling of comradeship that obliterates our alienation and makes us feel, for perhaps the first time in our lives, that we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in the cause, feelings of selflessness, even bliss. Once in a conflict, the shallowness of much of our lives becomes apparent. The fruitless search to find fulfillment in the acquisition of things and wealth and power is laid bare. The trivia that dominates our airwaves is exposed as empty chatter. War allows us to engage in lusts and passions we keep hidden in the deepest, most private interiors of our fantasy life. It allows us to destroy not only things, but human beings. In that moment of wholesale destruction, we wield the power of the divine, the power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth, the frenzy of this destruction, and when unit discipline breaks down, or there was no unit discipline to begin with, frenzy is the right word, sees armed bands crazed by the poisonous elixir our power to bring about the obliteration of others delivers. All things, including human beings, become objects to either gratify or destroy or both. Almost no one is immune. The contagion of the crowd sees to that. For, Simonval writes, is as pitiless to the man who possesses it or thinks he does as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. And those who have the least meaning in their lives, the impoverished Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the disenfranchised North African immigrants in France, even the legions of youth in the splendid indolence and safety of the industrialized world are all susceptible to war's appeal. I do not miss war, but I miss what it brought. I could never say I was happy in the fighting in El Salvador or Bosnia or Kosovo, but I had a sense of purpose. This is a quality war shares with love, for we are also able to choose fealty and self-sacrifice over security for those we love. This is why war, at its inception, always looks and feels like love, the chief emotion war destroys. We are tempted, maybe even encouraged, to reduce life to a simple search for happiness. Happiness, however, withers if there is no meaning. The other temptation is to disavow the search for happiness in order to be faithful to that which provides meaning. But to live only for meaning, indifferent to all happiness, makes us fanatic, self-righteous, and cold. It leaves us cut off from our own humanity and the humanity of others. The ancient Greeks understood the perverse attraction between love and death in wartime. When Achilles killed Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons in the Trojan War, he fell in love with her as she expired on the battlefield. He murdered love, and once he murdered love, he himself was doomed. He courted death. Aphrodite, the goddess of love, had an illicit affair with Ares, the god of war, who is hated by all the other gods, with the exception of the god of the underworld, to whom he steadily brought new souls. We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love. The ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity, is real. But this is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks of 9/11. Suddenly, we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a kind of nostalgia for its warm glow. Wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out in his book, The Warrior's Reflections on Men in Battle, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. And many of us will admit that we never really had a friend, and even the most fortunate of us have very few. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. We can all have comrades. The danger, the external threat that comes when we have an enemy does not create friendship. It creates comradeship. And those in wartime are deceived about what they are undergoing. This is why once the war ends, these comrades again become strangers to us. This is why after war, we fall into despair. In friendship, there is a deepening of our sense of self. We become, through the friend, more aware of who we are and what we are about. We find ourselves in the eyes of the friend. Friends probe and question and challenge each other to make each more complete. They draw the secrets out of us and know our inner core of being. For we reach and change others, and we ourselves are changed. When we plunge to the depths of our inner life, the depths that expose our insecurities and incompleteness, those depths that often lie beyond articulation. In comradeship, the kind that comes to us in patriotic fervor, there is a suppression of self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-possession. Comrades lose their identities in wartime for the collective rush of a common cause, a common purpose. In comradeship, life is ecstatic and corporate, as opposed to friendship, where life is singular and individual. In comradeship, Gray reminds us, there are no demands on the self. This is part of its appeal, and one of the reasons we miss it and seek to recreate it. This is why once the war is over, once the danger that linked us together is past, these feelings are instantly extinguished. Sebastian Hoffner, who was a lawyer in Nazi Germany, wrote of this comradeship in his book, Define Hitler. He noted that comradeship destroys the sense of responsibility for oneself, be it civilian, or worse still, the religious sense. Comradeship always sets the cultural tone at the lowest possible level, accessible to everyone, he wrote. It cannot tolerate discussion. In the chemical solution of comradeship, discussion immediately takes on the color of whining and grumbling. It becomes a mortal sin. Comradeship admits no thoughts, just mass feelings of the most primitive sort. These, on the other hand, are inescapable. To try and evade them is to put oneself beyond the pale. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group. And this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death, and this is what the God of war demands from us. Think finally of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. To friends, the prospect of death is frightening. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. We do not see war in the images of war presented in films and novels, nor in the mythic narratives the government and the press spins out for us. We never saw war in the televised images from Iraq. The war is always carefully packaged, the way tobacco or liquor companies package their own poisons. The titillation is there, but in doses we can digest. The reports give war a coherency and logic it never has in battle. We taste a bit of war's exhilaration, but are safe. War from Iraq is seen through the prism of the U.S. military, and it comes complete with manufactured heroes, feel-good stories about our own, and an enemy that is always painted as barbaric and uncivilized. We can thrill in the perversity of war, even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or documentaries that present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. Weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers, and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall and standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. As I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once we live in the midst of fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier, after a few seconds of combat, believes in the myth of war anymore. And this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater. This experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front rebels, who, when I arrived in El Salvador, were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters in cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road to Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something the photographers who would stand and take pictures found a necessary balm to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town where we ran into rebel units, now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then, as I rounded the corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. Rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded and crying out in pain. One died yelling in a sad cadence for his mother, his desperate and final plea cutting through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first, his cries haunted me. Soon, I just wished he would be quiet. The firefight seemed to go on for an eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the war of the movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream. I was safe. I made it back to the capital and, like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time I came back. I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part in all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who covered the war, had a slew of close calls, and then called it quits. He moved to Miami and took pictures for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, and interesting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. Just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents that seem to us immortal, and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the Thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents, is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard, and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. This is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. The job of killing allows our senses to command our bodies. The killing whips fighters into greater orgies of destruction, hedonism, and perversion spirals out of control. The comradeship of war actively works to stomp out all feelings of love, of tenderness, for love alone shields us. The most important part of the individual life, which cannot be subsumed in communal life, is love, Hofner wrote. So comradeship has its special weapon against love, smut. Every evening in bed after the last patrol round, there was the ritual reciting of lewd songs and jokes. That is a hard and fast rule of male comradeship. And nothing is more mistaken than the widely held opinion that this is a safety valve for frustrated erotic or sexual feelings. These songs and jokes do not have an erotic or rousing effect. On the contrary, they make the act of love appear as unappetizing as possible. They treat it like digestion and defecation and make it an object of ridicule. The men who recited rude songs and used coarse words for female body parts were in effect denying that they had ever had tender feelings or been in love, that they had ever made themselves attractive, behaved gently, and used sweet words for these same parts. They were rough, tough, and above such civilized tenderness. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity. The normal order is turned upside down. Better to give yourself up to the lust of war, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, to defend love, can be self-destructive. But in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote. And there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties. The study found that a common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive, psychopathic personalities. During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I once interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I saw other soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia. This necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. The necrophilia is hidden under platitudes about duty or comradeship. It waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milo Vangelis' memoir of the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, "Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration. War ascendant wipes out eros. It wipes out delicacy and tenderness. And this is why those in war swing from rank sentimentality to perversion with little in between. When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley, and I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level the Bosnians, running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle, her teeth were decayed, and some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet, they admitted, these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, when they had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void that the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again, they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by that common sense of struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, no longer sure of what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, that allowed them to love men and women they hardly knew, indeed whom they may not have liked before the war, had vanished with a last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to come and visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past two decades did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then I was back in Gaza, and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should return. I knew then that it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in Sierra Leone along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of Thanatos, of the death instinct, was never mentioned in the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it, but for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed. I had worked with Kurt for 10 years, starting in northern Iraq. Literate, funny, seems the brave are often funny. He and I passed books back and forth in our struggle to make sense of the madness around us. His loss is a hole that will never be filled. His ashes were placed in the Lions Cemetery in Sarajevo for the victims of the war. I flew to Sarajevo and met the British documentary filmmaker Dan Reed. It was an overcast November day. We stood over the grave and downed a pint of whiskey. Dan lit a candle. I recited a poem the Roman lyric poet Catullus had written to honor his dead brother. By strangers' coasts and waters, many days at sea, I come here for the rites of your unworlding, bringing for you the dead, these last gifts of the living, and my words, vain sounds for the man of dust. Alas, my brother, you have been taken from me. You have been taken from me, and by cold chance turned a shadow and my pain. Here are the foods of the old ceremony, appointed long ago for the starvelings under the earth. Take them. Your brother's tears have made them wet. And take into eternity my hail and my farewell. It was there, among a few thousand war dead, that Kurt belonged. He died because he could not free himself from war. He was trying to replicate what he had found in Sarajevo, but he could not. War could never be new again. Kurt had been in East Timor, in Chechnya. Sierra Leone, I was sure, meant nothing to him. Kurt and Miguel could not let go. They would be the first to admit it. Spend long enough at war, and you cannot fit in anywhere else. It finally kills you. It is not a new story. It starts out like love, but it is death. War is the beautiful young nymph in the fairy tale that, when kissed, exhales the vapors of the underworld. The ancient Greeks had a word for such a fate, ekpyrosis. It means to be consumed by a ball of fire, and they used it to describe heroes. Thank you. I know there are microphones if anyone has any questions.
You mentioned that you were finally overcome with fear, and I was wondering why you think that finally happened to you, why you were able to break away from this addiction.
Because everybody has a finite capacity to deal with that kind of trauma, and I, as the years went by, no longer had the emotional and physical resiliency of youth. I think that war correspondents who do this over many, many years have a harder and harder time confronting that kind of trauma, but they don't know any other way to live. They can't let go. And I think there, you used to say there's always two kinds of war correspondents who get killed. Those that are green and don't know what they're doing, and those that have hung around too long and get sloppy. And so I think for me it was, all of that said, it was a long process of disengagement, because I think it was very much like an addiction, that lifestyle. And I had to learn a new way to live, which was difficult and hard. And the allure of going back was always there. And it, it killed two friends of mine in Iraq, Elizabeth Newfer and Michael Kelly. Kurt and I used to speak all the time about this, but Kurt couldn't let go. It's very hard to let go.
As you said, there are many like Freud who believe that war is something that's inherently built into humanity and cannot be removed, and therefore war is inevitable. On the other hand, Jakub Bronkowski says in The Ascent of Man that war is a cultural invention, something that has been invented consciously by man, that it is organized theft, and that it is conceivable that it can be cured by cultural means. Can you comment on those two positions?
I think one of the things that people who have not lived in a war culture have a hard time understanding is how whole societies can act in a way that almost guarantees their own annihilation. That the euphoria and the excitement and the intoxication of the crowd can propel a society over the cliff. And I think when we think about war, we have to stop thinking about war in rational, logical terms and begin to deal with what I think are those very dark impulses that can lead a society to almost quite consciously and willingly destroy itself. And I think that some of those impulses are circulating within our own society at the moment.
You've explained very well the attraction and addiction to war by someone who's been in it. The current warmongers haven't been involved in war. So what's going on with them? Are they addicted as you and your friends were?
Well, I think that the addiction comes from people who've been in violent conflict, that... the landscape and the experience of war is so unlike anything else. I mean, it you know, in the span of a 24-hour period, it can recreate probably every drug high known to mankind, either because you're zipped up on adrenaline or zonked out with no sleep and in a zombie-like state, or viewing a battlefield scene of such powerful and grotesque images that it looks hallucinogenic. And it's when you spend a long time in war, you're so alienated from a society not at war that you rush back into it. This is what I and my fellow war correspondents did for years and years. So that however debilitating and difficult it was, for instance, in the siege in Sarajevo, when we would get out, when I would go to Paris, there was something in me that wanted desperately to get back into the city, back in an environment which I had become accustomed to living in, back with people who at least understood a wartime state and what I was experiencing, because I just couldn't relate outside that wartime culture.
Thank you very much. That was quite vivid and perfectly horrifying. One thing I'm a little bit confused about is you talk about your own addiction to war, and I can understand how that could happen, but I'm not clear on whether you're trying to say that that's what happens to everybody who goes. You talk about the survivors being the aggressive psychopaths, and I don't really think that that's likely to be you, but I don't understand whether you mean that that also affected the people who break down from war. Is this addiction happening to all the young men and women who are in Iraq? Is this what would happen to me if I were in a war?
I think that it's not contradictory to hate war. I think many of us who covered war hated war viscerally and deeply, yet at the same time be constantly drawn to it. I think that, you know, I went into war, you know, I graduated from seminary and went to Central America at the time of the military dictatorships in Latin America because I felt it was as close as my generation was going to come to fighting fascism. So I went into war as an idealist, but I got perverted and deformed and caught up in the culture of war. And I think that when you spend a long time in that culture, you know, around that kind of trauma, you can't walk away unaffected. Everybody, of course, is affected at different levels. But it is possible to be physically and even emotionally maimed by war, yet want to go back. It creates, I mean, it is war, you know, war is zen. I mean, it thrusts you into the present in a way that you never were before. I mean, colors are brighter. It is. It has a powerful attraction, a powerful allure, and I think with all of its horror, sometimes we don't realize how seductive that allure is.
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to follow up on this question because I think Nancy's earlier point was that you had quoted a statistic that said 98% of the people who were in war actually went crazy. And I think that I grant your experience, and I think that many people share it, but it's also the case that we know that most people who go to war in many developing countries do so because they're afraid they're going to be shot if they don't go to war. And, you know, the young boys in Africa have to get drugged to go to war because, and they have to get drugged because they won't do it. And because adult people who presumably have a full range of human emotions aren't actually drawn to doing that. So I guess to speak in a little bit of social scientese, that you're selecting on the dependent variable in the sense that you're looking at war correspondents, and they're precisely the kinds of people who are going there by choice. But I don't know that that's necessarily representative of the range of, you know, responses people have. And I want to draw attention in particular to your account of Sarajevo. I spent a good deal of time in the Balkans and was recently there in a few months ago. And it was really interesting because there was this kind of debate, and there were people who had exactly the response that you're describing and said, you know what, people are going to lie to you if they say anything other than this was the best thing that ever happened to them and, you know, this sort of thing. And then there were people who were there, and they said, were you crazy? Like, I was fighting because, you know, I tried to escape and I was going to get shot if I tried to go out, and so I had to be in the Bosnian army. Other people actually did get out and they didn't want to fight. And I guess I'm worried that there's a way that your remarks tend to, consolidate this kind of sense that war is inevitable and so forth, that it's part of a human pathology.
Let me first address the figure from the study from World War II. That the Army, and this has carried out, especially since the end of World War II, innumerable psychological, medical studies in order to get people to kill more efficiently. And what they found in that study was that after 60 days of continuous combat, you broke down. So that's why they pull you out for the 60-day period. And there's a great book by Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman, called On Killing, where he talks about that statistics, and he sums it up by saying, after 60 days of continuous combat, you either go crazy or you were crazy to begin with. It shows the limitation by which you can sustain that kind of trauma. And even soldiers that have a kind of meltdown are often pushed back into the conflict. Eventually, it's what they're doing in Iraq. So, I mean, there's heavy post-traumatic stress disorder now among the soldiers and Marines in Iraq, but the psychologists are not allowed to remove them permanently. They're supposed to bring them back, patch them up together, and throw them back in to be re-traumatized. As for the attraction, I mean, let's go to Yugoslavia. There's a perfect example of a country that committed collective suicide. There was no reason for Yugoslavia not to walk away, the country in Eastern Europe most equipped to integrate into a European economy. And you had there, you know, a kind of a hearkening back to these mythic stories about Chetniks and, you know, the feudal Croatian Teutonic Knights, and I won't bore you with all this stuff, but they had these wacky mythic narratives that whipped up all sorts of crowds. And you had, we can't underestimate the importance of propaganda. You had 4 years of constant bombardment of lies and fabricated atrocities and pictures from World War II of Ustasha killing people broadcast by Serb television before you got one Serb to cross into Bosnia, and he was paid, Arkon, to begin to carry out ethnic cleansing. So the society had to be conditioned, and there had to be a kind of manufactured alienation. You know, we know from the book that I did where we quoted all these studies, the second book, that 98% of all human beings have a natural reluctance to kill. But those who create war, especially in the modern age, know very well how to break that down. Another World War II study found that only 20% of combat soldiers fired their weapons in combat. So the Army worked very hard to figure out how to raise that firing rate. And what they did is through essentially operant conditioning, the same way you train a dog. They simulated battlefield conditions. They replaced round bullseye targets with human-shaped targets so that by the Vietnam War, the firing rate was up to 90%. But along with it came a correlating increase in post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think that you're right to point out that there is a kind of natural reluctance. However, there are all sorts of mechanisms, especially in a modern state where you can be bombarded with propaganda, with emotion, with images that are emotionally resonate, with that break all of this down and allow societies to disintegrate. And while, yes, I'm sure that there are, you know, my father fought in World War II and hated the war and came back, was virtually a pacifist, but for every figure like that, from the conflicts I've been in, there are many, many, many more who thrill in it. You know, they may eventually sour on it. I think they do, and they oftentimes come to a point where they're emotionally and spiritually exhausted and spent, but that attraction or allure is real. And, you know, when you went into towns in Bosnia and found these militias who were killing everything in sight and burning all the houses, they had a godlike quality. You couldn't speak to them. I mean, their eyes were glazed over. They muttered gibberish. You know, I think the most difficult thing for those of us who've been around war is to realize how easy it is to commit atrocity. That darkness lies within all of us. That line between the victim and the victimizer is razor thin. And that's what's so frightening, I think. One of the most frightening things one takes away from this experience, it's something that preoccupied Primo Levi. And many people speculate, finally, you know, was fundamental in his suicide.
Hi, good evening. I'm a student here at UCSB, and I'm also I'm a member of an Israeli family. I have immediate family here and family in Israel. Obviously, none of us condone any of the atrocities that have been going on. It's obvious on both sides. I feel like a piece of me is going with every person that's died in Israel. So at this rate, I feel like there's not going to be much of me left. But in situations where two societies or, analogous situations where they've gone through cycles of diplomacy and war and diplomacy and war, what do you think are any alternatives?
I think the situation, I spent a lot of time, and I spent 7 years in the Middle East, and because I'm an Arabic speaker, most of my time in the West Bank and Gaza, most of my time in Gaza. And I think the situation between Israel and the Palestinians is very similar to the situation between the Americans and the Iraqis. That you have what Robert J. Lifton calls these atrocity-producing situations. It comes out of his work on Vietnam, where when you have military forces, especially in urban settings, where you are surrounded by a hostage population that hates you, when you have an elusive enemy that you can't find. I mean, roadside bombs are a very common weapon in Gaza as well as in Iraq. When you have Fedayeen or Shabab that fire at you and then melt away. When comrades of yours are wounded or killed. When walking down to a store to buy a Coke means somebody can come up and put a bullet through the back of your head. It becomes very easy to look at everyone around you as the enemy and to, in fact, strike out at innocence as a kind of revenge for the actual killers who you can't find. And I think that's the sad story of what's happened with the Israeli occupation in Gaza and the West Bank, and I think we see it in Iraq today. And this kind of a reaction only fuels the conflicts. It plays into the hands of the extremists because radical movements are built on the backs of martyrs. The biggest recruiting weapon that the FMLN guerrillas had in El Salvador were the death squads. And it's why the American intelligence community and counterinsurgency experts who had learned the lesson in Vietnam worked so hard to shut the death squads down because they realized that that was key to breaking the FMLN, one of the keys to breaking the FMLN. So those kinds of colonial occupations, I think in the long run, are untenable because when you occupy a populace that lives in such despair and feels they have nothing to lose, they are willing to bleed. I mean, I think at this point the Palestinians are willing to bleed in a way that the Israelis are not. The Iraqis are willing to bleed in a way that we are not. It may take a few years, but I'm always reminded of this when I go and land in the airport in Algiers, and when I walk in, it says, "Welcome to Algeria, land of a million martyrs who'd fought the French." We'll do two more. two more questions, or one more, if there's only one.
Thank you. In your book, you thank your father and another clergyman, and you yourself went to seminary. I'm wondering what a culture of peace would be, and if your own religious background and upbringing informs that.
Well, I mean, for me, war is always tragic. I don't like the term just war. War always empowers the worst elements of society, those who have a penchant for violence. But I've been in conflicts where people are so beaten down and repressed that I can understand why they resorted to violence. I mean, sitting in Sarajevo during the siege, 2,000 shells a day, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day. All you had to do was look at the Drina Valley to see what the Bosnian Serb forces were going to do. The Drina Valley was completely, the Muslim population was completely driven out and killed in incredibly large numbers. I mean, there were bodies clogging, you know, parts of the Drina River. One could understand why a Sarajevan during the siege would pick up a weapon to defend his city, his community, his family. That doesn't save him or anyone else in the city from the pernicious and dark effects of war. And one of the examples of this is that in the initial stages of the siege of Sarajevo, the defense of the city rested in the hands of the criminal class, Cello, and these people who became sort of war heroes, who were gangsters. They had access to weapons, they knew how to use weapons, and they were violent by nature. And when they weren't manning the barricades to hold off the Serbs, they were usually hauling some elderly ethnic Serb couple out of their apartment and looting it and stealing their car and often as not marching them out to a ravine and blowing their brains out. You know, that the moral order in war is always turned upside down. But in the end, you know, to sit in a basement in Sarajevo during the siege and talk about the possibility of nonviolent resistance or pacifism in a extreme context like that would sort of evoke gales of laughter. So I can understand how it happens. But you know, once you ingest the poison of war, especially if you don't understand what that poison is, it can kill everything that's decent and good within your society. So I think that, you know, cancer patients may have to ingest a poison to fight off the disease. But if they don't understand what that poison is, it can kill you. I think it's much the same way with war. And it's very much why I wrote the book, to explain what the poison of war is. But ultimately, having been in situations like El Salvador, where they tried, you know, peaceful demonstrations in the street and in 79, they set up machine guns on the roofs of the buildings in San Salvador and gunned them down. I'm not condoning in any way the FMLN, but I understood why they existed and why peasants would join them. One more.
I want to thank you for how real and genuine and honest your sharings were as a journalist. I'm an emerging visual journalist. And you said during a war, real war reporting does not exist. And I believe it does exist, but it doesn't get through. I wanted to just open up a little dialogue about that, because what we see in the States, example, when the contractors were killed and hung from the bridge in Iraq, it didn't get printed here, but it got printed overseas. There are war photographers that are shooting, as you said, the pools of blood that are showing everything. But it's not filtering in. We're getting what we want to see, in a sense. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think you raise a good point that, you know, if you were watching Al Jazeera or even European television, you were certainly seeing a lot more of it. But you have to remember that there is always a difference between coverage of nations or correspondents who come from nations where their own countries are not involved in the conflict. We could be more explicit, somewhat more explicit, about what was happening in Bosnia because we weren't fighting there. But if you were a Muslim or a Croat or a Serb, you worked pretty hard to keep the horrors of war from the public, because real pictures would be so revolting that it would be very difficult to wage war. And while you're right that some of the images are more gruesome, I know from having been in marketplaces and around water taps where there was heavy shelling that the raw brutality and horror of what you saw was never filtered out, that the only people who actually see war are the people who are there, that the war is very carefully sanitized. Yes, you can see an artful picture and maybe a little, but you don't begin to. I mean, you know, watching a videotape of somebody with their legs blown off, bleeding to death for 6 hours, which is not uncommon in a war situation, is something that no one's ever going to broadcast. It's just too subversive. It's too difficult for, it would challenge too much the myth. And again, you have the situation, you know, I don't know that I want my kids watching it. So, I mean, how do you handle that? I don't know. I think the best way to handle it is to dismantle the myth that is used to sell us to go into war and dismantle it and expose the lie for what it is. But you make a good point. So, thank you very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.